session number 20369, Reel 1.
Dr. Wedenfeld, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Where or when?
Where?
In Otwock, a health resort just south of Warsaw, in Poland.
Which year was this?
1925.
Could you tell me something about your family background, please?
It was a typical middle-class family. My father was a doctor, a pediatrician, specializing in children tuberculosis, which was rampant. And the place I was born in was actually the health resort specializing in treating TB. My mother was a bacteriologist, had her own lab, clinical pathology at home. I had one brother, 6 years older, who actually left Poland in 1936 and was in the British Army through the war.
And where did you go to school?
I went to school in Otwock, in the same place. First to the primary school, then to the secondary school, up to the third grade, we called it. And when I was 14, the war started, and that put paid to my education for the time being anyway.
Can you take me through what happened to you on the 1st of September 1939, please?
On the 1st of September 1939, we woke up. That was a Saturday morning, I think. No, Friday morning was the 1st of September. We got down to have breakfast, and I heard some sounds as if it were coming from upstairs. Well, I went upstairs to on the terrace, and I saw a group of planes coming from the direction of Warsaw. The sounds we heard was bombing of Warsaw, and in the next minute there were a few bombs dropped on Otwock on the first day of the war. They hit one orphanage, and there were several dead and wounded, and we had already organized kind of firefighting parties, and I was in one of them. I was terrified from the word go, but wouldn't dare to show it. And my father has already left home about a week before the war started, and he joined the army. I mean, he was mobilized into the army. He was a medical officer in the hospital in the fortress of Brest-Litovsk, which was east of Warsaw. And days passed very quickly. There was no more bombing of Otwock, but they were constantly bombing Warsaw just north of us, and we heard most of that. And on the 6th of September 1939, there was a radio broadcast by Colonel Umiastowski. He was the government spokesman, calling anybody, everybody capable of bearing arms to go east to join the army, because new lines of defense were to be organized on the Narew-Bug River. That's what we heard. And with the British and French help, we will hold the Germans on this new line of defense. So I was only 14, but quite strong, and with several friends, we left Otwock and marched east. And the following morning, on the road, we were found by a couple of German fighters, and There were again quite a few killed and wounded on the road when they struck the road. But after another couple of days, I managed to get to Brest, but I just missed my father by several hours because the hospital, I was told that the hospital was already evacuated in southeasterly direction. So I left a little note in my father's deputy's hand for father, giving an address further east, because a couple of the friends I was with had some relations there, and that was the only address I knew in eastern Poland. And we managed to reach that particular place called Prużany, another 100 kilometers east of Brest, mostly on foot. We managed to get there. While my father's hospital was evacuated only a day later, I missed him, that was all a mistake. But anyway, he was evacuated, and on the 17th of September, Russians, of course, invaded Poland from the east, working in collusion with Germans. Father's unit was taken prisoner. They took all the officers, mostly doctors from this hospital, put them on a marketplace in a town called Krzemieniec, surrounded them with machine guns and told them to pray. And when the night came and most of the Soviet guards were drunk, my father escaped because he had that little piece of paper from me telling him that I am somewhere in eastern Poland, and he was determined to find me. So he managed to escape. His brother, another doctor from the same hospital, refused to go with him, and he was eventually killed in Katyn. But my father managed to get away and found me. After a while...
How did your father find you?
Because he had this piece of paper with my address, and he made his way. It was about 200 kilometers. He made his way mostly on foot, sometimes on some peasant cart. He was afraid of getting on a train because he was still in uniform. He took all his insignia of rank off. He was a captain in the Polish army, but he took all the insignia off, and even the buttons with white eagle, he cut them off, and he managed to find me. And then we got back to Brest-Litovsk. I went to school in Brest-Litovsk for a little while, and father worked in some pediatric dispensary. And then we decided to go back, or rather father decided to go back to Otwock, to our house. And literally the evening we were ready to cross illegally the river Bug to go into Germans occupied Poland, our mother crossed it in opposite direction and got our address from somebody and found us literally about 15 minutes before we were supposed to leave in a taxi to start our illegal journey to the Warsaw area. And we stayed in eastern Poland. At one stage, my parents decided to go back again, and we went to... And there was a German commission, I think it was in May 1940. And at that stage, we either had to accept Soviet citizenship or to declare that we want to go back into Warsaw area occupied by the Germans. And my parents decided to go back. The main reason was that my brother was abroad And staying in the Soviet Union meant to us that, my mother especially, that she will never see him again. So we decided to go back, but somehow this German commission had a quota, and by the time our turn came in the queue, the quota was filled and they rejected us. So we returned home, which was Pinsk by then in eastern Poland. And about 6 weeks later, but the exact date was 30th of June 1940, the local militiamen came about 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning and took us to the station, telling us that we are going back to Warsaw, put us on cattle trucks, or we spent the rest of the day in terrible heat in that station. It was a very hot June. And then the train moved, and it was only about 2 o'clock in the morning when I woke up. I realized that we were going northeast instead of west. So it was a kind of deception to stop people, rebelling against it. And we spent in the train, in those cattle wagons, 8 days. And twice during those 8 days we got some soup. Occasionally we got water and some bread. And after 8 days we disembarked in a place called Kotwas. From there we traveled another day in lorries to a place called Pietrakowo, which was about 100 kilometers east of the river Dvina, northern Dvina, in the direction of Ural Mountains. And from Pietrakowo we had to walk another 42 kilometers on a footpath along the river Uftyuga to a place called Lesopunkt Swoboda and Uchasto Kwasza, which means settlement called Kwasza, part of a timber production settlement. It was a very peculiar place. It was about 20 to 30 buildings, mostly log barracks. There were 400 of us. There was only one militiaman. His name was Borisov, with an old rifle on a piece of string hanging from his shoulder. There was no need to guard us because the place was so isolated. The only way out was that footpath, 42 kilometers long, to Pietrakowo, the kind of local county's capital, if you want, that was about 2,000 inhabitants. Escape from that place was impossible because we were surrounded by forest. And we worked in the forest. Men had to work until the age of 65, I think. Women are up to the age of 55. I wasn't yet 16 then, I was 15, and therefore I was not supposed to work. But my father made arrangements with the local authorities that I will go to work in place of my mother, who wasn't 55 yet. So my mother was left alone, didn't work at all, and my father worked either in the forest or on some local construction of another barrack, and I worked on all kinds of jobs.
What kind of jobs were you given?
The first job was marking the ends of the logs already stacked up on the river side. I did that for several weeks. Then I worked in the forest itself on felling trees. At first I was given a job of cutting the trees cleared of branches into suitable pieces, standard length pieces. Then I helped on other jobs. Eventually I got my axe stuck in my leg here, here somewhere, and I was off work for about 5 days. And then I worked in the settlement itself on cutting, by hand of course, the logs into planks for floors. And one man was on top of those logs and I was under them. It was really the very heavy physical work, even so I was supposed to be a convalescent and underage as well. But I did that for about 2 weeks. Then I worked in the local smithy as a hammer boy. Then I went back to the forest and actually started felling trees, and I liked that better than anything else, but it was a bit dangerous here and there.
Why did you like felling trees?
One seemed to be more in charge of what one was doing, I think. I don't know, but it was more satisfying work, I saw.
What was the supervision of the work like?
I mean, there were a few master foresters walking about, and they used to come at the end of the working day also to measure our output, because we were paid for our work depending on the output, and we were supposed to pay for our food in the canteen, for bread which was in the shop. It was rationed, of course, but we had to pay it, so we had to pay for it, so we had to earn our money. There was no other supervision. One had to learn. There were a few Russians working nearby as well, and one had to learn from them as one got along. And the worst job eventually I got and did for the rest of the winter, through the winter, and that was about 9 to 10 months, was working on the ice road. The ice road is a form of transport. You know, when the snow starts coming, it starts coming very fast, and within a week the whole area is covered with 4 or 5 feet of snow. And during the summer they prepared a track through the forest so that the working area can, you see, the timber we produced had to be got to Arkhangel, to the port. So therefore it had to be all transported to the riverside and then floated down the river when the river starts flowing in the summer. And transporting timber from the working side to the riverside at the distance of about a quarter or half a kilometer is not so difficult. But when one goes further away from the river, 10, 12 kilometers, then this transport is a problem, transporting this unwieldy and bulky and very heavy material. And what they do there is they cut a track from this intended working area to the river along a stream of some kind. Then a horse is attached to a kind of wooden roller to compact the snow. The track is about 3-4 meters long. Then the snow is compacted. Then another little sledge goes with two knives, plot-like, and they produce two grooves in this compacted snow, parallel grooves, and then once they are watered, they become kind of ice rails. And then on a contraption like you can see here, you can carry 5-6 cubic meters of timber instead of less than one when you can carry in the summer. But this ice road has to be maintained. That means it goes along a stream. One has to cut a hole in the ice, fill a cistern with water. The cistern has two holes over the rails, and you have to cover 11 kilometers, was our ice road, with water. Sprinkle it all along the way. We had 11 kilometers of the road and about 11 ice holes, but the problem, of course, in the middle of the winter is that the ice holes disappear during the day, and you have to cut them through every night, starting from scratch. And there's a hell of a lot of problems with the buckets which you have to use to fill the cistern. Buckets getting iced, and they are getting heavier and heavier and take less and less water. The cistern is getting iced. The frost, the temperature dropped to 30, 35 degrees centigrade below zero. On a number of occasions, by the time we got back to the settlement in the morning, because we had to work at night, that road is a one-way road, so therefore the maintenance can only be done at night, because during the day it is used. And by the time we got back to the settlement, quite often the temperature was down to 35 or 40, and the people were excused from work, because 35, I think, was the limit, while we worked all night with temperatures even worse than that. Quite early in this time, we discovered that one had to sprinkle one's coat and shoes and gloves with water. And the water froze almost immediately and produced probably the best insulation one could have. I used to call it my private igloo, because that's really what it amounted to. And we worked on this as a maintenance team, my father, my girlfriend, Helena, and myself. At first with a Russian called Alyosha. He was one of the master foresters specializing in this ice road business. And he told us how to do it. Eventually we had to do it ourselves. And that was probably the worst winter I ever had in my life. And it lasted from about October 41 until end of May 42. And then suddenly the spring was there, and the ice road just disappeared over a few days, melted away, and we had to go back to working in the forest near the river and use ordinary sledge and this kind of thing. We were in November 1941, General Sikorski, who was the commanding officer of the Polish forces in the West, came to Moscow, and some arrangements were made whereby the Poles were released from the camps, from re-education settlements, as ours was, from all kinds of exiles. And our release came in early September 41. Just a second, I am getting a bit mixed up with the dates. We left in September 41. And There was no way out from this settlement. It was only that footpath along the river, but it was all right to have our luggage brought on canoes when we walked on our way to the settlement, but to leave it, we had no help whatsoever from the authorities. That means there were no boats to take our luggage on, and luggage, our belongings, were the most important thing in Soviet Union, because you can always barter something for bread or for whatever. And we had to build rafts. And we built roughly about 20 rafts for 400 people. We had to cut the trees, fell the trees, clear them, but we are expert on that already, cut them into logs. Every raft needed about 20 logs. There was not a single nail to hold the raft together. We had to learn from a friendly Russian how to make a raft just using birch twigs, kind of made into rings to hold the logs together. We had to make the oars for the rafts, and it took us a good week to make those 20 rafts, and we left the settlement on the either 10th or 11th of September 41. Only half of the rafts managed to go all the way to the port of Krasnoborsk on the northern Dvina River. The remainder never made it, and one way or another had to make their way. Nobody perished on the way, nobody died, there were no terrible accidents, but people had to make the rest of the way on foot. And from then on, it was a question of making our way south. Our first destination was Astrakhan. It was a peculiar destination, but when we were issued with our release documents in the settlement, we had to give a destination to which we would like to travel, because nobody in the Soviet Union, whether it was war or no war, was allowed to travel anywhere one wanted to. One had to have a document allowing you to buy the ticket. And there were long discussions what destination we should give to the authorities, and during those discussions I decided that I wouldn't mind visiting Astrakhan because of caviar I knew was coming from Astrakhan. This is an anecdote, it sounds like an anecdote, but it's really a true story. So I said to my father, won't we go to Astrakhan? So father immediately realized what I had in mind, and for knowing no better, he said, okay, we'll go to Astrakhan. And because Pan Doctor, or Doctor Sir, was going to Astrakhan, out of those 400 people in our settlement, at least 300 or more gave their destination as Astrakhan. And after a very long travel by raft, on foot, on trains, and eventually in a luxury ship down Volga River, we managed to get to Astrakhan. But they wouldn't allow us into the town, and they converted the Astrakhan Port Park into kind of temporary camp for refugees. It was thousands of people were bivouacking in this park. And to make us go away, they didn't give us any food, they didn't give us any water. It was a 4 days of starvation. And then they offered us work in various villages outside Astrakhan, and we decided to go to a place called Kopanovka. But it was another deception. There was no work for us, no accommodation. And by then we heard that Polish army, one of the divisions of it, was organized in a place called Tatiszewo near Saratov. So we managed to get there on train. And in Saratov, my father, who went to the camp to see the commanding officer, who happened to know my father from the Polish Bolshevik War of 1917,